Okay, I have gotten the signal that we are good to go. We're also live on Facebook. So let's get started. Hi, everyone. The name of this webinar, again, is After Abbas, the Politics of Palestinian Succession and the Future of the Palestinian National Movement. I want to say hi to everyone in the US and Israel and Palestine and in Jordan, where one of our panelists is sitting right now, and other places in the world. This is the latest in Partners for Progressive Israel's webinar series called Conversations with Israel and Palestine. My name is Ron Skolnick. I organize these webinars on behalf of Partners for Progressive Israel. Before I hand it over to today's panel, I'm going to note the Partners for Progressive Israel is an American not-for-profit dedicated to the achievement of a durable and just peace between Israel and its neighbors, and that includes an end to Israel's occupation. Partners supports Israelis working to ensure social justice, civil rights, Jewish-Arab partnership, and equality for all of Israel's inhabitants. The organization seeks to deepen Americans' understanding of Israel's and Palestine's complexities so that they can better advocate for a progressive future for all the inhabitants of the region. Partners is glad to be bringing this webinar to you for free. If you enjoy it, if you want more programming like it, and if you can, please visit progressiveisrael.org. And make a contribution. I will make one programming note before introducing the panel. A week from today, Wednesday, September 13th, there'll be another webinar, and it's called From the Protests to the Ballot Box, Prospects for Progressives in Israel's Upcoming Local Elections, the elections are taking place on October 31st. That's going to be a co-production with the Abraham Initiatives, and it's going to feature Dr. Laura Wharton, a member of the City Council in Jerusalem, Amir Badran, a member of the City Council in Tel Aviv Jaffa, and Keti Piasecki, a member of the City Council in Bat Yam, and they're all running for re-election this year, so that should be fascinating. A quick note, the chat is open and the Q&A function is open. The chat is for conversation amongst the audience. It is not, I repeat, it is not where you should be directing your questions to the panel. That should be the Q&A. The chat is not going to be monitored by the moderator for questions. So please put all your questions into the Q&A and your conversations in the chat. So without further ado, let me move over to introductions and we can get started. Daoud Kutab is a Palestinian journalist and media activist. He's a former Ferris Professor of Journalism at Princeton University and is currently Director General of Community Media Network, a not-for-profit media organization dedicated to advancing independent media in the Arab region. It is registered in Jordan and Palestine and administers Radio Al-Balad in Amman, Penn Media in Ramallah, and Amman.net, the Arab world's first internet radio station, founded in 2000. Born in Jerusalem in 1955, Kutab studied in the US and has been working in journalism ever since 1980, first in Arabic print press before moving into the audiovisual field. In 1995, he helped establish the Arabic Media Internet Network, AMIN, a censorship-free Arab website. He established and headed for 11 years the Institute of Modern Media at Al-Quds University. Nathan Brown is a professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University and a non-resident senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. During the current upcoming academic year, he is a fellow at the Hamburg Institute for Advanced Study. Brown received his BA in political science from the University of Chicago and his MA and PhD in politics and Near East studies from Princeton. Brown is the author of 8 books, including Palestinian Politics After the Oslo Accords, and the editor or co-editor of 6, including Israel, the One State Reality, which has been gaining a lot of publicity and came out last year. Between 2013 and 15, Brown was president of the Middle East Studies Association. And in addition to his academic work, he serves on the board of trustees at the American University in Cairo. Last but not least, our moderator today, Dr. Diana B. Greenwald. Dr. Greenwald's research focuses on the politics of the Middle East, nationalism, conflict, and state building. She obtained her PhD in political science from the University of Michigan. Her current book manuscript is called Mayors in the Middle, Indirect Rule and Local Government in Occupied Palestine. And it's soon to come out under Columbia University Press. It examines Palestinian politics under Israeli occupation. It draws on interviews, over 50 interviews with mayors, municipal council members and staff, and also local level data on the Israeli-Palestinian Authority security regime, election results, and municipal budgetary outcomes. It sounds fascinating. Dr. Greenwald's research has been published in academic journals such as Political Science and Politics, as well as ones more in the mainstream, such as Washington Post, 972, and Foreign Policy. So I've introduced our panel. Let me hand you over to the panel. Let me hand you to our moderator, Dr. Dana Greenwald. I'll be back at the end to wrap up proceedings. I hope everyone has.
All right. Thank you very much, Ron, and welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to my co-panelists. So we will begin with several kind of stage setting questions, and then we will make sure to make time for the audience Q&A at the end. So as Ron mentioned, if you want to post questions just throughout the discussion, please do use the Q&A feature if there are questions directed at the panel, and about 15, 20 minutes to go at the end of the panel, I will start collating and taking your questions. So just to kick things off, I think I'd like to turn first to Daoud and ask you to help us set the scene here. So Mahmoud Abbas, as mentioned in the description of this panel, 87 years old, has been in office since 2005 as the president of the Palestinian Authority. His mandate expired over, I believe, 14 years ago. And so we know that this day might come, perhaps sooner rather than later, when he will no longer be in power. And so hence this question of what might become of the Palestinian Authority after Mahmoud Abbas. And so can you help us sort of with a broad sketch, maybe understand why there's so much uncertainty about this question and what are kind of some of the main political and legal factors that are at play?
Thank you so much. And thank you for following this discussion. As you said, President Abbas is 87 years old, although his father lived 100 years. So we don't know, even though he's a chain smoker, that we can't expect things. But anyway, the Palestinians don't have a constitution, but we have a basic law. And basic law says that in the absence of the head of the president of the authority, the speaker of the legislative council will rule for 60 days during which elections take place. The Legislative Council, ever since the split between Gaza and the West Bank, has not been held. And in 2016, Mahmoud Abbas enacted the Constitutional Court. The joke around Palestine is that it's a very beautiful building was created for one decision. And it is to basically authorize or legitimize the dissolving the Palestinian Legislative Council. So right now the council is not, it doesn't exist, it has been dissolved. And therefore the legal discussion is that the council has always been subservient to the Palestinian National Council, the PLO's parliament in exile, in which 132 members of the Legislative Council were part of the national or the parliament in exile. And so legal authorities say that the speaker of the Palestinian National Council will basically, since it's the higher body to the Legislative Council, which doesn't exist, will be the person who will replace an absent Abbas for 60 days during which elections will take place. It's very ironic that the current speaker of the Palestinian National Council, Fatouh, Rouhi Fatouh, is the same person who was the head of the Legislative Council when Yasser Arafat died, and he He was the president for 60 days during which Mahmoud Abbas was elected. And as you said, he's been in power ever since. So most constitutional lawyers, legal people say that the legal part of the succession should go easily because Rouhi Fatouh is around. He's the speaker of the council and he's already done this before. So he will do it again for 60 days. Of course, the big question is who will be elected. And of course, anybody can run. The question is who will the mainstream PLO's Fatah movement will nominate. And here is where some people expect that there will be trouble and some kind of a conflict. I personally don't think there will be conflict for the following reason. Mahmoud Abbas has about four different positions. He's the president of the Palestinian Authority. He's also the chairman of the PLO Executive Committee. And he's the director or chairman of the Fatah movement. All three of these organizations are powerful and have money. And so the thinking by many is that within Fatah, yes, there will be internal fighting who will be the number one person, but there is enough to go around that the other, let's say that two or three leading people, if they don't get the top position, they will still have a very senior position. And so the loot, the bounty will be distributed and people will be satisfied and they will be supportive of whoever is chosen as the lead Palestinian person, most likely the president of the authority, although some people say that being the head of the PLO might be more powerful, especially if the authority is falling apart and is bankrupt. But anyway, the question then is who will rule the Fatah, the movement that has money and arms and has personnel on the ground. And most of the leaders and the governors are all directly or indirectly loyal to the Fatah movement. And here, there are two technically important people that we have to keep an eye on. Mahmoud Abbas's deputy is Mahmoud Al-Alul. He is from Nablus. He well-respected. His son was killed in the second intifada, a 20-year-old. And so he's very well-respected. He's very clean, doesn't have corruption on his hands and so on. The second also important Fatah person is Jibril Rajoub. Jibril Rajoub is from the Hebron area, the south of the West Bank. He was, unlike Mahmoud Alul, who was never in prison, he used to be with the PLO outside. Jibril Rajoub was in prison for 19 years and he was released on an exchange. And he is seen as more of the internal rather than from Alul, who is the external. And Jibril is also head of the Palestinian Football Association, which is very popular with sports and so on. So he has the youth support. Three other people that are potential candidates to be the head of the Fatah, not necessarily the head of the, because there will be elections and maybe somebody from Hamas will win, maybe an independent would win. But in Fatah, Hussein Sheikh is seen as important, although not one of the top two. He's the present secretary of the PLO's executive committee, and he's close now to Mahmoud Abbas. Rajoub has always said, kind of jokingly, that after Abbas is gone, it's different than the day before Abbas is gone. So it's kind of a criticism of Hussein Sheikh, who's basically propped up by Mahmoud Abbas. Two other people that one should keep an eye on, they're reneged or they're used to be members of Fatah and they're now outside of Fatah, although they continue to say that they are Fatah. One is Mohammed Dahlan, who used to head the Fatah in Gaza, and he's now very close to the leaders in the United Arab Emirates, and he was kicked out of Fatah on charges some people say are questionable. And the second is nephew of Yasser Arafat, Nasser Qudwa, who used to be the head of the PLO and the Palestine delegation of the UN. He ran a separate list when there was elections, and now he's creating a kind of a group of his own that are trying to get back to Fatah if Mahmoud Abbas is gone and the new leadership might want to continue. Finally, Marwan Barghouti, the Palestinian Fatah leader who is in prison on five long life terms, is very popular, and there might be a scenario where the Palestinian Fatah movement might nominate him as president, even though he's in jail, and a person would be his deputy, would be running things until he's out of jail. So these are the different scenarios that are possible.
Okay, great. Thank you, Dawood, for that really comprehensive response in thinking about some of the inner negotiations and machinations that are going on within Fatah. So, Nathan, I wanted to turn to you, for any reactions to what Dawood just said, but also, it sounds like, okay, there might be a plan for this immediate period of the transition, who's going to assume power on an interim basis from perhaps the leadership of the Palestinian National Council, as Dawood mentioned. But there's also, I think, this looming question about whether and if free, fair, open elections will take place. And so can you perhaps give us a little bit more elaboration on the legal framework and perhaps the potential for these elections to be carried out smoothly or to be carried out at all, versus the potential of another path where the PA perhaps seeks to deepen its authoritarian control? And which of these paths do you see as more likely? And which of these paths do you think is more likely to spur either the survival or the collapse of the PA?
Thanks. That's a great question. It's also a difficult question. I'll answer it directly, and then I'll go and react to some things that Dawood said, which actually might tie back to this. I think any kind of succession process that didn't somehow involve elections at some point would be deeply problematic domestically. It would bring in a new leader who wasn't necessarily seen as legitimate. Dawood gave a very good overview sort of the legal and the political framework and some of the people. There's a couple points that I want to sort of bring out from what he said. One is, and it's clear from what he says, these various institutions do have rules. They have clear rules for succession. The basic law is fairly clear. PLO has its own internal bylaws and so on. There are these structures and so on. And my sense is that the rules will be followed as much as they can be, but they're not very determinative. And one of the reasons is a lot of these structures are broken. The parliament has been doesn't exist. The Constitutional Court, I would mention its earlier decision. The current Chief Justice of the Constitutional Court, the one who was just appointed, it's a president's former legal advisors. You go to the PLO, and it's sort of the same group of people. The PLO right now, which is essentially the umbrella for the entire national movement, is effectively bureaucratically a set of offices attached to Abbas and to the presidency right now. So it's not all that viable an organization. So they have rules, they'll probably follow them, but a lot of this is sort of circular and disconnected from any structures of accountability. I think Palestinians still take the PLO seriously as a symbol, and so some kind of PLO blessing of whatever procedure will probably be necessary at some point. But this ties me back to elections. Even under the basic law, or even if the PLO parachutes in somebody or has a caretaker figure like Rabih Fattouh as an interim president, basic law is fairly clear that there has to be presidential elections within 60 days. And in a sense, the mechanisms are all there. There's a Central Election Commission, which is probably one of the best functioning parts of the Palestinian Authority, even though it hasn't had much to do. But it's maintained voter rolls. It's ready to go out. It's by international standards. It's got a very strong reputation. There's a clear electoral law and framework. So if there were a political decision to hold elections could easily be held. The problem is, who's making that decision? And the problem is not simply the PA leadership. My guess is, left to their own devices, most of them would want to have elections just to bless the presidency. But you've got a very, very complicated situation, essentially for political and diplomatic and even some sort of technical reasons, to have elections that didn't have very strong international support and Israeli acquiescence would be pretty difficult. And so you begin by saying, Abbas's his term is about 15 years or so overdue. That's true. He's not the only reason that there haven't been elections. He hasn't pushed for them, but nobody else has either. Nobody else of these critical actors. So if you want to know why there haven't been Palestinian elections, there are an awful lot of people to blame, a lot of actors to blame. Some of them are international, I would say American government, Europeans, Israeli government. There are an awful lot of actors to blame for the failure to have elections. If succession were to take place without elections in some way, shape, or form, I think they would be deeply problematic. In a recent visit there, I trot out this tagline to Palestinians when I was talking to them. I said, it seems to me the problem you have is that you've got officials, but you don't have leaders. And I would get nods every time I would say that. And I think a succession that took place without elections would produce somebody who was recognized internationally and whose signature would make certain things, into legal force, but would have absolutely no traction socially and politically in Palestinian society.
Okay. Dawood, did you want to follow up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say a few things. I think we talked about the technicalities, but we didn't talk about the politics. And I think it's very important that we talk a little bit about the politics, because whoever will succeed Abbas will have to make an ideological decision. Abbas has worked on a kind of one-track mind, which is the diplomatic track. He's been opposed to any kind of armed resistance. He's been totally against the rockets from Gaza. So the question is whether there will be agreement or consensus on continuing the same political path or changing the path. And this will determine a lot of who will be chosen. I'll give an example. If, for example, there is consensus that Abbas's diplomatic policy is the most viable and it's the only thing that will work because, a few armed people are not going to stand up to one of the most powerful armies in the world, and therefore, and it's counterproductive, these armed struggles and so on. So Hussein Sheikh, the secretary of Fatah, who is very close to Abbas now and who's close to the Israelis and Americans, might be a candidate. If, on the other hand, a hybrid kind of a policy where there is a more of an acceptance to the armed struggle, then you have maybe Alun, who's much more of a military guy, who's closer to the military. If you want to have something closer to the first intifada, a nonviolent but very powerful, active resistance without arms, then you would think of Jibril Rajoub, who was active in the first intifada. So you have different ideologies, and then you can think of different people who would fit that ideology. Another point that I want to mention to the leadership issue, which Nathan correctly spoke about, is that in the very last few weeks or months, I wrote a piece in Al Monitor calling it Mahmoud Abbas 2.0, in which Mahmoud Abbas is basically all of a sudden decided to change 12 of his governors. He's going to have a reshuffle of the government. He agreed to the Fatah Congress on December 17th. We have a date now that the whole Fatah movement is going to have a Congress where they'll choose a new central committee and so on. And I think if all these things work as they are supposed to work, we will have a much better idea of not so much on the individuals, but on the political path that will emerge. What is the roadmap for liberation? Is it the armed struggle? Is it the political diplomatic struggle or a hybrid? And I think that could, in some way or another, give us a much better idea of who might be the one or the leaders of the new movement. So these are things that I wanted to kind of highlight.
Yeah, thank you for that. I was actually going to ask a related question. And I just want to remind those tuning in that if you have questions for the panel, please do drop them in the Q&A, not in the chat. And I'll be checking that and collating some of those questions in the last 20 minutes or so. So starting around 1:10 plus or minus, we will start posing your questions to the panel. So two things came up in that exchange that I think we could elaborate on a little bit further, and I'm going to put them both out there, and then I'm going to give you each a chance to respond to either or both. The first is the position of various outside actors on the holding of elections. We're talking about presidential elections in this case, but we could also be talking about legislative elections within the PA, and the role that, you know, international players such as the US, EU, and others might play and have played historically in that process, and what role they might play in the future in either supporting open, free, fair elections or perhaps getting in the way of that somehow. And then I think the other question is about the position of Israel, and especially given the current Israeli government, where you seem to have a certain level of disagreement even within this far-right coalition, which of course is expansionist and annexationist towards the West Bank, but towards the Palestinian Authority. You know, you have some like Bezalel Smotrich, finance minister, effectively head of the civil administration, who wants to and has explicitly stated numerous times, seeks for the PA to collapse and does not want to support its continued survival. And then you have others within the government, within Israel, within the military as well, that are going to perhaps have quite different views about this, about the PA. So I guess this question has to do with the position of international and other regional actors in so far as they might shape the prospects for elections. And then the second point, which I think comes back to something that Daoud was just mentioning, you know, at least Daoud, you were speaking about within Fatah, this question about ideology and about what approach should be adopted for the Palestinian struggle moving forward, the legitimacy, the effectiveness of armed resistance versus, you know, unarmed or nonviolent pathways. You know, if you look at recent developments in the West Bank, you look at polling data, for example, you see a majority of those in the West Bank and Gaza support the armed resistance, support some of these new actors and groups and militias that are emerging on the ground in the West Bank. I think the most recent poll I looked at for the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research from June had 80% of respondents opposed to these militias surrendering their arms to the PA. So there's a certain question about how Fatah approaches that. But I think there's a broader question of what the implications of that are for this possible transition and for possible elections and for other parties and other groups that might may or may not participate or impede these elections. So two very broad topics. And I guess we'll move maybe first Nathan, just to keep our alternating pattern, and then go back to Daoud.
Okay. All right. They're big questions. I'll try to keep my answer short. And if I don't succeed, let me know. The international attitude towards elections, I think, has been sustained disinterest, especially by the United States, beginning to shift a little bit. You can see that, you know, there was parliamentary elections that were scheduled a couple of years ago that were called off at the last minute. I think a much more muscular American attitude would have probably made them more difficult to cancel. There's a push now, you know, Hamas has talked about having local elections in Gaza, and there's some sort of talk about this. So I think the United States, I mean, the kind of the signals I pick up, which are pretty indirect, is a greater interest in elections, basically out of an alarm of what's happening within Palestinian Authority structures and a feeling that something, some life has to be breathed into them. Europeans tend to follow the Americans. I think they've been friendlier to elections all along, but they don't take initiatives. Israel, I think you're exactly right. For part, I mean, Israel is important in a few ways, mechanically just moving ballot papers around and so on. But Jerusalem is a really big issue. And there are clear provisions and arrangements that were used in previous elections for Palestinian residents of Jerusalem. And it would be difficult, I think, for this Israeli government, the current one, to go through with those. But there is the split that you're talking about, Diana, that I see. There is part, essentially, the Israeli security establishment, the diplomatic establishment, and the signals from Netanyahu personally are that Palestinian Authority is a pain, but it's better there than not there. So there might be some openness. Smotrich, I'm going to be blunt. You referred to him, not sure he wants a PA around. This person is more radical than I think people realize. He introduced his own plan, which basically says Palestinians should either accept their subordinate status, leave, or be subject to military action. I mean, this is about transfer. This is references to Palestinians in pretty strong terms of the Israeli far right, as Amalek, the memory of Amalek is supposed to be blotted out. This is the rhetoric that's there. And it's frightening. I've never heard anything like this from ministers before. And so the idea that they would acquiesce in Palestinian elections would be difficult. Second question about resistance. I look at the same polls that you do, and what's interesting besides what you quoted is what seems to me a real generational shift, right? When we've been talking about procedures and we've been talking about leaders, we've been talking about people, names, and organizations that don't have a lot of purchase with the younger generation. Who remembers the last Palestinian elections? Who here has ever seen the PLO? And what I found on my recent trip there was the younger you got, the more radical people got. I often get asked the question, when is there going to be a third intifada? For some Palestinian youth, it started already. It's taking different forms. It's not like the first or it's not like the second. But the idea that any resistance is good, violent, nonviolent, anything that you do to resist is good, is one that I think most of the younger people that I talk to subscribe to. So the idea that there is some kind of diplomatic path forward is one that not only young people don't believe in, they don't even remember a time when anybody believed in it. So it's kind of a scary time, I think, in Palestinian politics for those who hope for any kind of diplomatic process.
Great.
I want to start with the last thing Nathan said. The last time there was negotiations, other than like Aqaba, Sharm el Sheikh thing, was in 2014, 9 years ago. So there hasn't been even an attempt, even a photo opportunity on this issue. So I agree. Yeah, the diplomatic line is quite unuseful in most people's minds. I think I want to kind of stop for a moment to talk about elections, because I think there are two types of elections that we were talking about. I think Nathan spoke very properly about the elections, most likely the legislative elections. And when the recent elections were called and then were abandoned, there was no contesting by Hamas on Abbas's running for president. They had already conceded, okay, you can run for president because you know people abroad and you can bring in money and we need you to be there. But the question was on the legislative, and it was on the legislative that there was fear that Hamas would do well also on the West Bank. And I think that's why the Americans and others and Israelis, some of the Arab countries, were not too excited about having elections, and they succeeded in convincing Abbas to cancel them. Maybe he himself didn't want to make the same mistake he thinks that he made when Hamas won the last elections. So I think there will be, if after Abbas, there will be presidential elections even without the legislative election, because they would want to legitimize whoever would be chosen. So I think that is going to happen regardless of whether there will be parallel legislative elections or 3 months later or 4 months later, the new president will kind of re-engineer the situation so he and his party would do better in the elections. I think the Arab-Israeli American role, the international role in whoever is the front person, it should not be belittled. I think a lot of people talk about that. Who would be the proper face of Palestine? Who could, negotiate with the Americans and with Israel to bring about some kind of a change? I think people are aware that not every name that I mentioned are the right people that can get the acquiescence and the support. I mean, you need the nearby countries, Jordan and Egypt and Israel, to somehow sign off or at least not oppose, because if they oppose whoever is going to be, it's going to be bloody. So I think people think about that. Now, again, there might be a situation where you have a kingmaker or you have somebody who is the leader, let's say, of Fatah, but will not be the face of Palestine, you know? Maybe, let's say, Jibril Rajoub would be the leader of Fatah, but he will then appoint or bring in, maybe Salam Fayyad, or maybe put in Nasser Qudwa, or somebody who's a proper face diplomat, so they can be the face, but he would be the person appointing him and behind him. Now, of course, he might run on his own, and this would be problematic, but it's possible. I'm not saying it will happen, but it's possible that you will see a power structure shifting, especially if the Palestinian Authority is going to be weaker, it's going to be without much money. It might not be very attractive for people to want to have that thankless job, and they might prefer to be on another one of these three or four positions I mentioned. Now, we didn't talk enough about Hamas, because I think Hamas is an important party that must be discussed in detail. The best case scenario is that if there is some type of a reconciliation, that Hamas will be awarded, if I can use the word, the leadership of the PLO abroad. So maybe somebody like Khalid al-Mash'al would be the token speaker of the Palestinian National Council, and that would satisfy Hamas and will not force them to be involved in the day-to-day negotiations, which would mean they would have to recognize Israel and all these other issues. So that might be a scenario that is a possibility for Hamas. Local elections, they might happen in Gaza, but I think the problems are much bigger than the local elections. Okay.
Great. Yeah. Thank you for sort of predicting what one of my questions would, a follow-up question would be about Hamas. And I think we actually did have a couple questions in the Q&A related to Hamas. And I'm starting to group some of those questions that are coming in the Q&A. So we'll get to those in a minute. Just to follow up, Dawood, do you think Hamas would be satisfied with that outcome of essentially gaining leadership within the PLO? And is the assumption that do you think they would contest the presidential election? Do you think they would participate in the presidential election for the PA? We've seen historically that Hamas has varied in how it has approached PA elections. You know, sometimes, especially at the local level, it has participated. At other times, it's boycotted. And so I would put that question to both of you of what we might expect, since indeed, you know, we do still see, I suppose, a plurality of Palestinians in polling data that don't really support any of the major parties, but among the major parties, Hamas is still obtains a dominant share of support these days. So what can we expect from the movement in approaching this question of transition? If you want to elaborate a little bit, Dawood, just briefly on what you've already said.
And sure. I think, as I said, you're absolutely right that if it was in a normal situation, young people are sick and tired of both and all existing political factions, and they would want somebody totally outside of them. The reality is it's not going to happen. The reality is that, you know, there is hundreds of thousands of employees of the Palestinian Authority. Fatah has membership in so many places, and Hamas has, you know, all kinds of unions and student councils and kindergartens and all these organizations. So I don't think that the young people who might be disappointed with the factions would be able to put forward a person, and that they would all, you know, they would win a general election. So I know that that's what they would like, but I don't see that as happening. So I think we're all of us are stuck with the most likely with the presidential. I don't think Hamas is interested in contesting that. I mean, they might put somebody up for kind of a show, but they will not. I don't think they desire to run the Palestinian Authority because they are not able to run Gaza. They're not going to be able to run the West Bank and Gaza and ensure enough money comes in and so on. They know that they will fail even worse than they have already failed. So I don't think they will contest the executive branch. I think their power is in the local and the legislative, and I think they will try to continue to fight for that. With the PLO, there is a big question because many people outside of Palestine do support Hamas. And again, whether the re-engineering of the PLO would allow Hamas to have the majority or a slight close to the majority or 40% of the candidates. You know, these are questions that are part of the fact that there's no agreement because they don't agree on this issue. But I think the most likely scenario is that they will find a formula to allow Khalid al-Mash'al to run the PLO outside, but will not have much power or money.
Nathan, did you want to follow up with anything?
No, I think that makes an awful lot of sense. I mean, I would say that, you know, the Islamic resistance movement was not founded to be the, you know, the governing authority for Gaza. So that's not a long-term that's not a long-term outcome for them. But how to get out of that, I think is a question. And they're not necessarily, I think, in any hurry. But one path might be integration into Palestinian governing structures. I think Daoud is absolutely right. Running the Palestinian Authority is not something they want to do, even when they won the parliamentary elections. It took some of them a little bit by surprise, and they tried to form a coalition government. They didn't want to have full responsibility. The presidency, I think, would be a nightmare for them. But some serious role within the PLO, some serious integration of Palestinian national structures would be good. On the other hand, the current deterioration, especially in the West Bank right now, is one that offers them real opportunities for reemerging in the West Bank, where they haven't been much of a presence since the split. That's almost 15 years as a semi-underground movement. Wow. And that kind of pulls in a different direction. So I'm not sure what they would do. It's an opportunistic movement, and they may just decide to make a decision when they see what opportunities are presented to them.
Okay, great. So I think it's time for us to move to some of the questions. We've got a bunch of questions that have come in the Q&A. So if I could group them. So there's one set of questions that has to do with Palestinian civil society and essentially the idea that, you know, free and fair elections presume the existence of a free press and a robust civil society. And so the impression that the attendee raises here is that those social institutions are remarkably weak in the occupied territory. So how can elections be carried out in this context? Maybe some reflections on what the broader role is of civil society. We had another question come in asking, instead of these typical old political kind of Fatah cronies, what's the possibility of maybe a leader emerging from civil society that could contest the elections? So Daoud first and then Nathan.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with the questioner that we do need a free press and civil society being able to work effectively. And the long semi-dictatorship of Abbas has weakened a lot of these institutions. On the other hand, the fact that the Palestinian government has weakened is bringing back old days when there was no government and the Palestinians ran things through civil society. And so a number of civil society organizations have flourished despite Abbas's attempts to crush them, and of course, the Israeli attempts to crush them. And so I'm not totally pessimistic. I'm more worried about the media, because the Palestinian government's media machine is very powerful. Palestine TV, radio, newspapers are much more in the hands of the Abbas loyalists, and I don't think they will give them up. And so I don't expect free and fair elections in terms of the free press. Certainly Hamas will not think that they will be free, even though Hamas has its own now TV station and newspapers and websites and so on, but they're nothing compared to the machine of Abbas's government and media outlets. So, but look, elections under occupation has always been a big, almost oxymoron. I mean, you can't really have genuinely free elections when the Israelis are calling the shots in many places, sometimes arresting candidates and denying people travel permits and so on. But again, I think in the succession issue, what will emerge from the Central Committee of Fatah would be most likely what we will see on the ballots, and would most likely be who the next president will be. On the legislative issue, it's a free fall. We don't know what will happen on that level.
Nathan, on this question of civil society.
On civil society, I think the in both the West Bank and Gaza, there's just been a tightening over the last 15 years or so. And Palestinians complained about this, I think more. It used to be what I would hear about would be complaints about corruption. Those still continue. But now there are complaints about repression and authoritarian rule and civil society organizations having visits from security services and that sort of thing. So it is a more constrained atmosphere. The real question to me is what's going on at really kind of a grassroots level. The first Intifada, for instance, was preceded by a period of sort of grassroots organization flourishing. And Daoud was talking about a Palestinian on a neighborhood by neighborhood basis, organizing things for themselves. I don't see much sign of that right now, but the society does seem to have that potential. And the possibility of a youth leader, I think it's a great question. Daoud was skeptical earlier on, and I think I share his skepticism, but the situation is actually a little bit complicated. You know, I had a conversation with a group of high school students when I was there. The name of Marwan Barghouti came up, okay, who's sometimes treated as a youth leader, even though he's not a young man anymore. And one of them looked quizzically at each other, and one of them finally said, "Oh, is that the guy who's in jail?" I mean, these names are not known to the younger generation, or if they're known, they're simply known as names. They don't have a real presence in the society. A couple of them, Jabril Rajoub, because of his sports role, does, because he's known as a supporter of youth sports. But what was remarkable was that when I would ask people, okay, so who are your heroes? I wouldn't get answers. They're not. This is not a rising generation that is organizing around new ideas, new organizations, new charismatic figures, or anything of the sort. They're full of sometimes despair and sometimes anger, but it doesn't seem to be gelling into any kind of movement that would translate itself into electoral politics. So when the focus is on elections, those groups tend to disappear. When the focus is on resistance in its various forms, that's when they really kind of capture the imagination.
Great. We have a second set of questions. So I'm going to pose, for the interests of time, I suppose, I'll pose two like buckets of questions. One pertains to the ongoing reports about potential normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia most recently, and perhaps more generally the processes of normalization that have come out of the Abraham Accords. But a couple questions about Israel, Saudi Arabia in particular, which Daoud, I know you've written about recently. And so in what way might this process that's underway shape what any kind of transition within the Palestinian Authority looks like, and or shape the approach or strategy of any new leaders? Dawood and then Nathan.
I think the Saudi issue is quite interesting in a number of ways. You know, when Trump was around and the Jared Kushner's deal was being cooked in Saudi Arabia and other places, the Palestinians, Abbas, said no in a very emphatic way. And then the Saudi relations with the Palestinians came to a halt. They basically stopped meeting with them, stopped giving money. It was really very bad. This time around, it seems that the Abbas government thinks that this is an opportunity to make some gains, especially at the UN. They think, okay, you know, Mohammed bin Salman is going to move whatever he wants to do based on what Saudi Arabia wants. And if we can leverage that, their interest in having some kind of a fig leaf from the Palestinians, then what we need is something that could put an end to dreams of annexation. And one of the ideas that has been around for a while, but is gaining ground, is for the Palestinians and the Saudis to demand something from the Americans, not from the Israelis. Israelis, with this government, nothing's going to happen. But to say, look, you're always supporting the two-state solution, but you've done nothing about it. We know that we're under occupation, and occupation's not going to end tomorrow or the next day. But why don't you recognize us as a state under occupation at the UN? Give us full membership at the UN. Let us be like every other country. And then as a state under occupation, we will then negotiate whether now or whether there is no elections in Israel. But we will no longer negotiate as people who don't have a state that are seeking to have a state. So the state issue, the idea of Palestine as a state, which if you follow a lot of the propaganda, they keep pushing away. They keep knocking at the, you know, Palestinians never existed, Palestine never existed, all this. So if the idea of a Palestinian state is recognized by the UN, the thinking of Abbas and some of his supporters and their colleagues is that if we can get the Americans to either abstain or vote for this issue at the UN Security Council, this would cement the concept of the two-state solution and the Palestinian state, even if the Israelis don't accept it. But at least there is no longer the question of whether there will be a Palestinian state or not. And the question would be what its borders are, what is its relations with the state of Israel, rather than whether Palestine exists or not. So that's what they're trying to do. And now there is a delegation that went to Saudi Arabia that will be meeting US officials, Saudi officials. And I think this is something that they're really pushing hard for. And Abbas is going to be in New York at the General Assembly to push. And they've apparently got strong support from China, from Russia, from all these other countries. But it's the US that is holding back. And they're saying, look, why are you holding back? You support the two-state solution. Look at what your Israeli friends are doing. You know, they're creating havoc. At least give us the recognition of a ballot. This doesn't cost you anything. And if somehow this is part of a mega deal, then even Democrats and Republicans in Congress might support such an idea, because this would have normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel, which a lot of the Democrats and Republicans want. And so that would be the deal, that in return for the Palestinians giving the blessing to Saudi Arabia, normalizing with Israel for whatever reasons and whatever they would get out of the Americans, the US and the US Congress would change the existing laws that prevent, that still consider the PLO a terrorist organization, would basically create normal relations between state of Palestine, which will be recognized by the UN, and Washington. And so there will be normal relations. The US consulate will be reopened in Jerusalem. The Palestine mission would be open in Washington. And that was also part of the electoral promises of Joe Biden. So in a sense, that's what he had, you know, run for in his election promise. And it's also a message to Israelis and to these crazy guys in Israel that keep, you know, trying to talk about annexation and so on. It would put an end to all that annexation talk. It might be a very far-fetched thing, but the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah is saying, here is a chance that could do something. If it works out, fine. If it doesn't work out, there would be no normalization. So there's nothing to lose. And if they, if we can get a full membership at the UN, then, you know, the Saudis are going to do whatever they're going to do. We're not going to stop the Saudis, but at least we can leverage our power with the Saudis. That's the idea.
Okay, so I'm just on this issue, Nathan, and then I'll ask my second bucket of questions, but on the normalization issue.
I think, yeah, don't cover leadership strategy very effectively. The one thing I will say, just sort of on a different note, is, you know, there are two big things happening in a kind of regional context that could affect Palestinians. One is this, the prospect of normalization with Saudi Arabia, and the second is what's going on in Israel. And what's remarkable to me is that Palestinians I talk to, they feel like spectators. They're kind of following it, but this is not something that they are really participating in, or that they necessarily really expect anything from. The focus is very internal, very local, very practical right now when you move beyond the leadership level.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see how that approach that Dawood's outlining can kind of be an attempt to lock in that diplomatic path, right, for whoever takes the reins after Abbas.
I'll give him a legacy. He will be able to resign saying, I got you recognition at the UN. Now I'm leaving and you guys can finish there. I mean,
right.
It might be an interesting kind of a scenario. Unlikely, but it's interesting.
Right, right. And how it plays out on the ground is maybe a different story. So another set of questions we had, I'll group together a few questions pertaining to women. Where are women in the Palestinian kind of political story, and particularly this question about leadership? You know, particular individuals are mentioned. Hanan Ashrawi, of course, is, I believe, still a member of the PLO Executive Council, or former. Okay. Okay. So either or both of you want to speak to this question, whether you see any prospect of change in the future in terms of women's representation in leadership?
Nathan, I'll pass.
Okay. I will say you certainly find women within leadership groups, you know, the Revolutionary Council, Fatah, and so on, in the Legislative Council elections, where women's seats reserved. So women are not absent from political life. When you're talking about succession, I've never heard any female name mentioned. When you move a level beyond that, I would say women are certainly numerically underrepresented, but they're not absent from any of these leadership structures. And I would also say that there are, you know, Dawood talked about sort of the history of Palestinian civil society. A lot of the oldest Palestinian civil society organizations are actually women's organizations. So there is a history of women's activism within various parts of Palestinian society that is still alive today.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting
for me.
Yeah, go ahead.
Look, I mean, I think when the Israelis and the PLO signed the Oslo Accords, the State of Israel refused to remove Fatah from the list of supporters of terrorism. So it's still, until this moment, Fatah is still considered a terrorist organization, even though Israel has the Oslo Agreement. So the question from an anonymous attendee saying that a person was arrested who is part of the armed wing of Fatah. There are a lot of people who are armed wing of Fatah who are now involved in some of these armed struggles. Most of them are not directly taking their orders from Mahmoud Abbas on Fatah, but there is a wing within Fatah, much more armed and rebellious, if you want to call it that, to the leadership in that sense. The person, another person says that it's a fascist dictatorship. Yeah, well, it's called whatever you want. It's fine with me.
How about the Mejid Feraj question? You had a couple wondering why his name wasn't mentioned.
Yeah, I don't think Mejid Feraj is leadership quality. He's fine. He's a nice guy, but I don't think they tried to kind of shine a media light on him a while back, and he failed miserably. So I don't think he's an intelligence guy, but I don't think has more to offer than that. That's it.
Yeah, and I'll just say on the women's role question, I mean, there are these stipulations for at the local level that certain lists have gender representation. And I think also for PLC elections, right? A certain number of women.
Every third person on any list has to be a woman. So 1, 2, 3 is a woman, 4, 5, 6 has to be a woman. So the top, every party, whether Fatah or independent party, every three people on the list, 3 persons on the list, 1 has to be a woman. So that is part of the laws that we have. So if we have legislative election, there will be many more women, you know, competing and hopefully, you know, shining in the legislative council.
Great. And there was a final question we didn't get a chance to get to. We're just out of time right now, about the Palestinian diaspora and their role in the selection of leadership. So just to clarify, those in the refugee camps, of course, within the occupied territories would be eligible to vote within the PA election. Yeah. But the broader diaspora, the question about their role would really be more relevant for
the PLO's National Palestine National Council.
Yeah, great. All right, I think that brings us to time. So I think Ron is going to join and close us out here. But I wanna thank Dawood and Nathan very much for this really insightful discussion. And thanks to the audience for all of your great questions.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you, everyone. That was a really riveting discussion. I really appreciate it, Dawood, Nathan, and Diana. I learned a huge amount. I hope everyone else on the Zoom broadcast did as well. I also want to thank Dinesh Sharma, my colleague, for all his behind the scenes work making this discussion happen. I hope you enjoyed the webinar. Just a couple of mentions from the beginning to wrap up, and those who weren't there right at the start. A week from today, September 13th, starting at 12:30 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time, there'll be another Partners for Progressive Israel webinar called From the Protest to the Ballot Box, Prospects for Progressives in Israel's Upcoming Local Elections. Those elections will be on October 31, but we'll be discussing them next week with Laura Wharton, Amir Badran, and Kathy Piasecki. So I hope you can join us for that. For those who missed the opening as well, I'll just repeat that while today's program has been free, generous contributions, of course, are what enable the organization to deliver these events at no cost. So if you can, please head on over to progressiveisrael.org, check out the website in general, upcoming programming, and if you can, make a donation. Thank you so much, and hope you can join us next time.
Thank you.